She focuses on criminal justice reform, voting rights, immigration and refugee rights, education equity, women's rights, reproductive freedom, and bullying prevention. In her role, she provides specialized legal advice to ADL staff in 27 regional offices around the country, files amicus briefs, and provides testimony at the federal and state levels, and advocates for policies that further ADL's mission of securing justice and fair treatment to all. In addition, Lauren sits on the New York City Bar Association's Civil Rights Committee and its Task Force on Mass Incarceration. Prior to joining ADL, she was a staff attorney at the Center for Family Representation in New York, worked at the Brennan Center for Justice, and she's also taught in NYU's Journalism Department. And with that, I will turn it over to Lauren.
Thank you so much, Samantha. Can everybody hear me on the line? All right. So thank you all for joining us today for this talk about voting rights. And today is a particularly auspicious day, I think, to be talking about voting rights because it has now been 52 years. Today is the anniversary of the tragic murders of Goodwin, Schwerner, and Cheney, who were killed in the Deep South in 1964 while trying to register people to vote. And so it's a sad reminder that people in our country died for the right to vote, and that it's a precious right, and we all need to make sure that everybody can, all eligible voters around the country can exercise that right to vote. So today we're going to be talking about the right to vote, about the Voting Rights Act that was passed in 1965, about the case from 2013, the Supreme Court case Shelby County versus Holder, which essentially gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act, and what we can expect from the 2016 election. So to start, we need to do a little bit of a brief history lesson. So going back to the Civil War, almost immediately after the Civil War, the 15th Amendment was ratified. And the 15th Amendment said that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And the second section of the 15th Amendment specifically gave Congress the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. And Congress did just that. In 1870, Congress passed the Enforcement Act, which prohibited discrimination in voter registration, and it actually prescribed criminal penalties for anyone who tried to obstruct the right to vote. And it was really successful initially. Right after the Enforcement Act, 75 to 95% of African American men in the Deep South were registered to vote. Of course, women didn't get the right to vote until much later, but it was very successful for African American men. And in fact, during Reconstruction and the period right after the Civil War, half of the lower house in South Carolina's legislature was African American, 42% of Louisiana's lower state house was African American, and 29% of Mississippi's state house was African American, which may be surprising to hear now because we think of what happened after Reconstruction. So Reconstruction ended in 1877. And at the same time, the Supreme Court struck down large parts of the Enforcement Act, which had been used to ensure the right to vote for all eligible Americans. And primarily Southern states, not exclusively Southern states, but mostly Southern states, began putting in place laws and practices that would bar African Americans from voting. So they started things like literacy tests, where the test for white voters would be simple, something like spell dog. For African Americans, the test could be as complicated as recite the entire preamble to the Constitution, or things that had absolutely nothing to do with the ability to read. There were grandfather clauses, which required people to that people could only vote if their grandfather had voted, which of course meant that people whose grandfathers had been enslaved could not vote. There were voting roll purges, where they would take off the names of African American voters from the voting rolls, voter ID laws, racial gerrymandering, so drawing lines according to try to limit the power of African Americans to vote. There were whites-only primaries. You name it, the states were trying it. And these cases were going up through the courts, and they were being litigated. And one by one, the courts were striking down these laws as unconstitutional, as violating the 14th and 15th Amendments. But during the time that they were litigated, in the 2, 3, 4, or 5 years that it would take for the cases to go up through the courts, the states would put in place 2 or 3 or 4 other voting laws and practices that would bar people from being able to vote. And so while during Reconstruction, 75 to 95% of African Americans were registered to vote in the Deep South. By the early 1900s, just a few years later, 90% of blacks in the Deep South had been disenfranchised by these schemes. In Alabama, for example, in 1902, only 1% of eligible black voters were registered to vote. The courts simply just could not keep up. And this continued for many decades and really came to a head on March 7th, 1965. For those of you who remember 1965 or perhaps who have seen the movie Selma, you'll recognize these images of Selma, Alabama. You can see in the foreground the gentleman who is down and is about to be hit with a police baton is actually Congressman John Lewis, and his skull was broken that day. So this was a march. It was supposed to be a peaceful march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, and there were two purposes to this march. The first was to advocate for voting rights for African Americans, and the second was to protest the death of a young man named Jimmie Lee Jackson, who had been murdered by a state trooper in February of 1965 when he tried to register to vote. And so people gathered on the bridge in Selma, Alabama, and they were met by really horrible violence from law enforcement in Selma. And these images went widespread. They were on the national news that night. It was covered around the country, and it really drew national attention to what was happening in the South with voting rights. So I wanted to take a moment just to talk about ADL's role in Selma and the larger Jewish community's role in Selma, because right after the initial Bloody Sunday, it was called, March 7th, 1965, Dr. King put out a call to people of faith and to people of good conscience around the country to come and join the protesters to march from Selma to Montgomery. And ADL heeded that call. In fact, 12 of our leaders from around the country, including our national director at the time, went to Selma and marched arm-in-arm with Dr. King and with the protesters from Selma to Montgomery. In this picture, you see Rabbi Maurice Eisendrath and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who were marching in the front lines with Dr. King. And in fact, last year, the 50th anniversary, we were looking through our archives and looking at some of the articles that were published at the time of Selma. And what we found, interestingly enough, was that thousands of people who were not Jewish during the march actually ordered and wore yarmulkes in solidarity with the Jews who had gone and who had marched with them from Selma to Montgomery. So immediately after the march from Selma, President LBJ gave this impassioned speech before a joint House of Congress. He brought them together and said that he was going to immediately bring to the House floor for a vote a bill, the Voting Rights, which would become the Voting Rights Act. Congress moved on it fairly quickly, and on August 6, 1965, President Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act. So what did the Voting Rights Act do? Well, there are two primary sections that we're going to focus on today because they are the primary sections that protect the right to vote. The first is Section 2, and Section 2 prohibits voting practices or procedures that discriminate on the basis of race, color, or membership in a language minority group. This applies universally nationwide, it applies everywhere, and it essentially allows the Department of Justice, nonprofit organizations, and individuals to bring lawsuits against states and localities that have put in place discriminatory voting laws. This section is alive and well today, and in fact there are a number of cases that have been brought around the country under Section 2, some of them ADL has been involved with. And so we'll get back to what's happening with Section 2 a little bit later. But the majority of the focus today is going to be on Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And Section 5 prohibits certain states and jurisdictions with a history of discriminatory voting practices, they're known as covered jurisdictions, from changing voting laws without what's known as preclearance from the federal government. And so what happened was Congress recognized that there had been this pattern in which during the time that individuals were bringing challenges to the voting rights or practices, that states were putting in place all of these discriminatory voting laws. And so they decided to flip it and said, before you can put in place any new voting rights, any new voting practices or laws, you have to first preclear that with the federal government. So which jurisdictions were covered by the Voting Rights Act? And I say that it's before Shelby County because, as you will find out, the Supreme Court struck down the formula that was used up until 2013. So the formula said that on November 1st, 1964, the jurisdiction had to have a test or device restricting voting rights, and fewer than half of eligible voters either registered or voted in 1964, 1968, or 1972. And so they were looking for these areas where there had been particular problems and where they had seen these patterns of trying to disenfranchise particularly African American voters, but voters who were in language minorities, Latino voters, marginalized groups. And you'll notice in the second part of the formula that it's not just up until 1965, it goes beyond 1965, and that is because the formula was updated several times over the years. So which areas and jurisdictions were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act? You'll notice that most of them are in the South, although not exclusively. Arizona and Alaska were fully covered. Alaska was particularly covered because of the issues with disenfranchising the Native Alaskan population there. You'll also notice that New York was partially covered, and that includes almost all of New York City, because there have been problems over the years with disenfranchising language minority groups and not giving people proper access to ballots in their own native language. So immediately after the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, there was a challenge brought. You might have assumed that there would be an immediate challenge in the courts to this, and South Carolina brought the case. The Supreme Court used original jurisdiction, and so they heard the case without it actually going up through the courts, and they invited all of the states to participate, many of which did. And they upheld the Voting Rights Act. In a very powerful decision from the Supreme Court, they said that there had been an insidious and pervasive evil which had been perpetuated in certain parts of our country through unremitting and ingenious defiance of the Constitution. And they felt that because of this past and because of the decades in which states kept trying to defy the Constitution, that they could then flip the burden and could allow for preclearance. The Voting Rights Act was incredibly successful, as you see from this picture in the election right after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Thousands upon thousands of African Americans registered and voted. And in fact, by 2012, we had more than 9,000 African American elected officials, the majority of which were from areas that were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And we had our first African American president, which would not have been possible without the protections of the Voting Rights Act. Around the country by the 1980s, approximately 65% of African Americans were registered to vote. And we think about that compared to before the Voting Rights Act, when only 1% of African Americans were registered to vote in Alabama. It was really an incredible feat. So as I mentioned before, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized a number of times throughout the years. So first it was set to sunset in 1970, and Congress reauthorized the bill in 1970, then it was set to sunset in 1975, and so on. In 1982, Congress made Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, so that is the one that applies universally nationwide, and it allows the Department of Justice and individuals to challenge voting practices that are discriminatory. So that was made permanent, and it would no longer had to be reauthorized. But Section 5 came up for reauthorization in 2006. And Congress overwhelmingly reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006 for another 25 years. They didn't do this lightly, though. There were more than 15,000 pages of records in the congressional record on this. They heard hours and hours of testimony. They received thousands of pages of documents about testimony. And what they found was that the Voting Rights Act was still necessary, and particularly Section 5 was still necessary. They found that the Department of Justice had actually objected to over 700 voting practices and procedures in recent years, that not only did they have a discriminatory impact, but two-thirds of them actually had discriminatory intent, according to the Department of Justice and according to the federal courts that were pre-clearing the laws. Many of them, they said, actually still looks like some of the voting practices and procedures that were in place before the Voting Rights Act and that the Voting Rights Act was intended to stop. So just to give you one example, there was a case in Alaska, and if you remember, Alaska was covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. There was a case in Alaska where one town had submitted a proposal to change where the voting poll places were. And it seemed like a pretty innocuous change, there wasn't much to it, except that the Department of Justice asked for more information about the population there and what this would mean in terms of changing the voting places. And what they found when they asked for more information was that because of the geographical structure of the area, every single Native Alaskan would have either had to fly or take a boat to be able to get to their new polling place. They wouldn't have actually been able to drive there. And so that's just one example of some of the things that have been blocked by the Voting Rights Act. But I mentioned before that right after the Voting Rights Act was passed, there was a challenge. That was not the only challenge to the Voting Rights Act. In fact, until 2013, when we got to Shelby County versus Holder, there had been more than a dozen challenges to the Voting Rights Act. And each time, the Supreme Court had upheld the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. But now we get to 2013, and this is Shelby County. And this is a county that is very close to Selma, Alabama. It is a county that had been a bad actor, if you will. They had, in recent years, tried to pass a number of different provisions that would have prevented people from voting and that had discriminatory intent to it. And so the piece that I didn't mention about the formula before was that there was a bail-in and a bail-out provision, meaning that if states and jurisdictions that had previously been covered had done well for the last 10 years, had not had to have any federal intervention, had not tried to pass or put in place any voting practices or procedures that would have a discriminatory impact, then they could bail out and they would no longer have to preclear their laws. Well, Shelby County was not one of those areas. They had, in fact, been engaging in discriminatory voting practices. Nevertheless, they brought a challenge to the Voting Rights Act, to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and then they said that the formula was out of date and was no longer constitutional. And in 2013, a very deeply divided Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision struck down the formula used for which states and jurisdictions would have to preclear their laws. I want to be clear that they did not strike down the idea of preclearance or the practice of preclearance. They simply said that the formula was outdated and that it was no longer applicable to today's society. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion, and he specifically said in the opinion that Congress could act to create a new formula, they could update the formula, and that they could then restore the protections of the Voting Rights Act. So as I said, this was a very deeply divided Supreme Court, and Justice Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, if you will, wrote an impassioned dissent in which he said, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And so essentially she predicted that as soon as the protections of the Voting Rights Act were no longer in place, that we were going to see a huge rollback in voting rights and that we were going to see a number of problems that had been prevented by the Voting Rights Act and by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act come to the forefront. And I am sorry to say that her prediction was right. Within literally a few hours of the Shelby County decision, a number of states that had voting practices or procedures that had been blocked by the federal government put those practices into place. So one of them was Texas. And in Texas, there was a voter ID law that they had submitted for preclearance, and it had been denied preclearance. The federal government found that it would be discriminatory. And this voter ID law required that people would have to have a state-authorized or a state-issued ID to be able to vote. This map that you can see here, which is from the Brennan Center, if you look at the black dots are where there are DMVs or other places that you can get voter ID to be able to vote. The red shaded areas represent the areas that have the largest Hispanic populations. And so you can see in a number of the areas that have the largest Hispanic populations in the state, there are almost no voting places. There are almost no voter ID places. And some places, people have to travel over 150 miles to be able to get a voter ID, which, of course, if you don't have a driver's license, that is almost impossible, particularly with very little public transportation. I wanted to take a moment here to just talk a little bit about ID, because I think that many of us assume that most, if not all, people have ID. We use our driver's licenses either to drive, or if we live in the city, perhaps we use them to fly or to buy alcohol. It's something that most of us have, I think, just as a general rule. However, there are costs to ID. I just renewed my New York State driver's license. It's $65 to do it in New York now. In other places, it's even more. So if you are living at the poverty level or working multiple jobs in order to meet and make ends meet, you may not want to spend $65 to get an ID. There are other people who simply can't get ID, people who were born at home, for example, in the 1940s or 1950s, who don't have birth certificates, don't have the underlying documents to get ID. There are all kinds of barriers to people being able to get ID. And a judge had actually found in Texas that there are over 600,000 people who will not be able to vote because of this voter ID law, 600,000 people who are eligible to vote but don't have the voter ID there. So I wanted to do a little exercise now, which is, can you use this ID to vote under Texas's law? So we'll see how this works online, but the idea is that I will show you an ID and then you can vote on whether or not you can use this to vote in Texas. So the first is a student ID. So can you use this to vote in Texas? Let's see if we can get this wall. All right. So I'm seeing 7 people say no and 1 person says yes. And the majority is right. You cannot use a student ID to be able to vote in Texas, even if it is a Texas university, a state university. Now the next one, we go to a Texas driver's license. Can you use this ID to be able to vote in Texas? Okay, you can vote now. Ah, 8 people are saying no, you cannot use this ID to be able to vote in Texas. And that is right, and it's a little bit of a trick question, where maybe this has flagged at the red circle, and that is that you can use a driver's license to be able to vote in Texas, but you cannot use an expired driver's license. And so if it has expired and you have not renewed it, you can't use it. And now the final question, can you use a concealed handgun license to be able to vote in Texas? Yes, 8 people say yes, you can use a concealed handgun license, and that is absolutely right. There is a very short list of IDs that you can use to be able to vote in Texas, and a concealed handgun license is one of those IDs. Well, we've actually had a number of students who have reported that they have not been able to vote in Texas, and in fact, ADL has worked with MTV on a petition. It is up right now, and it is ongoing to try to get college students interested and active in the right to vote. And we worked with a college student in Texas. He was originally from Virginia and is going to school in Texas and was not able to vote in the primaries this year because he had a student ID from Texas and he had a driver's license from Virginia. I couldn't use either of those to be able to vote. And so I think we may see that this coming November in Texas and in many other states. So in Texas, the cases are ongoing. I mentioned that there is litigation under Section 2 that is alive and well in Texas. There are a number of cases going on around the country under Section 2 in other places, but it's up in the air right now what will happen with Texas. There was a federal district court judge who struck down the voter ID law in Texas, finding again that 600,000 people would not be able to vote. That was overturned by the Fifth Circuit, but it is all being appealed. It's at the injunction stage, and so it's really unclear what will happen there in November. What we do know is that we've already seen a number of problems in the primaries, and Arizona is perhaps the best example of what we have seen going wrong in the primaries this year. So if you recall, Arizona was one of the states that had to pre-clear its laws under the Voting Rights Act, and that was lifted this year. And so there, without any kind of pre-clearance requirements, they closed a number of the voting polls. So in 2008, in Maricopa County, which is home to Phoenix and which has 4 million residents, including 2 million registered voters, they had more than 400 polling places. This year, because they didn't have to pre-clear any changes and they were free to do whatever they wanted with their voting practices and procedures, they dropped from more than 400 polling places to 60 polling places. In Phoenix, which is a majority-minority city, there was only 1 polling place per 108,000 residents. There we saw lines that were more than 5 hours long. Parking lots were full. People reported there were absolutely no handicap spaces, and so people with disabilities couldn't vote at all. There were reports that people were waiting to vote after midnight. The races had already been called, but they were still in line. We also saw that a number of people were bumped off the voting rolls or inexplicably their party affiliation had been changed. In fact, three of the people who work in our Arizona office were not able to vote during the primaries in Arizona. And so we are seeing a number of problems around the country, but Arizona was probably the most stark. And hopefully this is not a foreshadowing of what we will see in November with the general election. So what is happening and what can we do to protect the right to vote this November? Well, there is a bill pending in Congress now. It's known as the Voting Rights Advancement Act. It is a bipartisan bill, and it would create a new formula, as the Supreme Court said that it could. It would create a new formula for preclearance coverage, which would cover a number of states that have been bad actors in recent years. It would also create other protections for voting rights, including requiring all states and jurisdictions to pre-clear certain changes that we know have been used to disenfranchise minority voters, for example, racial gerrymandering. So looking at some of the areas that have the highest minority populations and when states and jurisdictions try to change those boundaries, that they would have to pre-clear that with the federal government. It would also require areas to publicize voting law changes that would go into effect within 180 days of the election. And so that would effectively flag for the Department of Justice and for organizations that there was a change there and it was something that they needed to look at and see whether they needed to bring a challenge to it in the courts. So we are actively working towards passage of the Voting Rights Advancement Act. We are lobbying Congress, and we are working to get that passed. We're working with a number of coalition partners. In fact, this week there is a very large push on Congress to bring this bill to the floor for a vote, because this Saturday is the third anniversary of Shelby County versus Holder. And so around that anniversary, there's a very large push to try to get Congress to vote on the Voting Rights Advancement Act. We are also working in the courts. We are filing amicus briefs in the courts and working to ensure that there is the right to vote for eligible voters. And we will be doing our very best and working extraordinarily hard between now and November to make sure that all eligible Americans who have the right to vote will be able to actually cast their vote and make their voices heard this November. So the work is ongoing. After this, you will get a follow-up email, and that there will be a link in there to an action alert for Congress, and we hope that you will sign on and you will help us push Congress to actually support the Voting Rights Advancement Act and give it a vote. So with that, I want to open up the floor for questions. So I see a question from somebody saying that hopefully we won't see the same problems in the general election that we saw during the primaries, particularly in Arizona. What, if anything, is being done to ensure that? Well, particularly in Arizona, the Department of Justice has opened an investigation and is looking into what happened in Arizona. There are also hearings at the state level in Arizona. The Secretary of State in Arizona has been investigating what's going on there, and they have pledged to open more voting places than just the 60 that they had open for the primary. So Arizona is being addressed. There is litigation ongoing in Texas and North Carolina, really around the country, about some of these other laws, and we are hoping that we will see some resolution of that before November. But it is, quite frankly, an uphill battle. So thank you. So the next question is, what can we do in addition to giving money to ADL to support this effort, to support expansion of voting rights? Well, the first thing I think is actually this petition that we have for Congress, both with MTV. We have about 15,000 signatures for that petition right now that is to put pressure on Representative Goodlatte, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, to bring the bill to the floor for a vote. And so we can send around a link to that, as well as our own advocacy page. We have a letter to members of Congress that encouraging them to bring this bill to the floor for a vote and to actually act on it. We encourage you to call your member of Congress. And in addition, they will be home in their home districts this summer. And so ADL around the country is working to have meetings with members of Congress and to impress on them the importance of passing the Voting Rights Advancement Act. And so we encourage you to get involved, to reach out to the New York Regional Office and to talk to them about meeting with your member of Congress to push this forward. So the next question is, what can state legislatures do to address the Shelby County decision? Can they enact state Section 5 type laws? So Section 5 is a little bit tricky in terms of anything that a state could possibly do, because Section 5 requires that the federal government look at what the state is doing. And so it's about the federal government policing voting practices and procedures. So the states can't do anything that would be akin to Section 5, but they can certainly police their own voting practices and procedures. They can have in place laws that would bar certain localities from doing anything that would have a discriminatory impact or a discriminatory intent. They can also make voting easier. It's really at the state level that they can increase early voting opportunities so that they can open more polling places, that they can make it easier to register to vote. And we are seeing that in some states. Unfortunately, we're seeing more states that are trying to make it harder to vote, but there are a number of states where they really are trying to make it as easy as possible for people to be able to vote. And so we are responding to that at the state level at ADL. We're responding both to the positive laws and to the negative laws and working to make sure that voting is as easy and as smooth as possible for everyone. And I see someone is saying here about the New York Assembly. Yes, the New York Assembly did pass a law. But it just passed the House. I don't believe that it's passed the Senate. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But this would be about clearing action based on a county-specific formula. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. Absolutely. That is something that we can work to get the Senate to pass. Unfortunately, I think, as many of you know, Albany is often just as tied up and as difficult to pass things in both houses as Congresses. There's another question now. Would you be willing to speak at local venues, e.g. synagogues, to educate our communities on this issue? Yes, absolutely. Please reach out. And the more people that we can get involved on this issue and educated about this issue and to care about voting rights, the better. And I think leading up to November, we really need to make an all-out push to get everybody involved on voting rights. Do you have any other questions? Okay. So I just saw one question about whether this was recorded. Yes, this was recorded, and we will be able to share this recording. And so if you have any questions or you want to hear anything again, please go back. You can certainly go back to the recording. You can you could also reach out to any of us. My email address is ljones@adl.org. Please feel free to send me an email with questions. But you can also please share this with people. If there are others in your community that you think might be interested and need to know more about voting rights, please feel free to share the recording of this webinar.
This is Samantha again. Thank you so much, Lauren. This was really informative, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to myself, Lauren, or any member of the ADL staff. I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thank you all very much.